Okay, so I have three epigraphs to begin with. The devils do indeed have to be summoned. That's Stuart Hall, Charles Critchlow, Tony Jefferson, John Clark, and Brian Roberts at the Center for Cultural Studies. Second epigraph. Can the world be as sad as it seems? That's Tobin Grissell quoting from Charles Manson. And the third is, noise is that decorative energy that invests the nation performance. Unnecessary, but without which, not enough. And that's Edward Kamau Brathwaite from History of the Voice. So, I'll begin. So, to listen to Handsworth's songs, from within the aesthetic and political ecology of what was and is called post-punk, in proximity to what is understood to be the British industrial music subculture of the late 70s, early 1980s, and mid-1980s, would require the rethinking of the parameters of post-punk, the precincts of industrial culture, the reconfiguration of what is described as Black British culture, as each of these are commonly narrated and historicized. To think Okwi Enwezor's idea of dub cinema by way of what John Comfort calls Black industrialism, would suggest that the theory of Black audio can be heard as an ecology in which the seditionary effects of punk, the mutational effects of dub, and what Catherine McKittrick calls the blacklessness of industrial music converge to constitute a cinesonic ecology that works to reorganize and to desediment the frontier effects that continue to sustain the cine cultures of the left in the UK and beyond, along the informally segregated lines of racialized aesthetics that continue to organize the images and the sounds, the noises and the voices that constitute the theories and practices of 20th and 21st century cinema and of the post-cinematic within and beyond the precincts of Britain. To think through what John Okomfor calls the sonic backdrop of the Black industrial requires the return to and the rethinking, the complication and the problematization of Black audio film collectives, collective theorization of Black audio as a practice of what might be called Black film, as a theoretical practice of what constitutes Black collectivity. As an audio theorization of what appears then and now as the collectivization of Blackness. As a collective audition of what Michael Boyd Gillespie calls film blackness, as a filmic collectivization of what will henceforth be known as the Black auditorium, it requires the return and elaboration of Enwezor's notion of dub cinema in relation to a Okomfor's formulation of, quote, a sonic backdrop which one could only call Black industrial. To begin to assemble Black audio film collectives enactment of the unthought of collectivity, a collectivity hitherto unthinkable in cinema's histories or theories, to draw together that which constitutes the collective's formulation of the unthinkability of Black audio, as the auditorium for thinking film's unthought capacity for Black collectivity. to think through the conditions of existence of and for the collectivity of Black audio films. An existence unthinkable within and beyond the conditions of film theory, denominated as white film theory. To think through the implications of Black audio film collectives' inauguration of its auditorium of the collectivity of what constitutes Blackness, its institution of Black audition for film, its initiation of the filmic collectivity of auditory Blackness, foreclosed by the historiography of filmic practices, ex-nominated as white filmic practices, is to think the elaborated theorization of the form of dub cinema, the theoretical formulation of the practice of Black cinema in dub, to think the practical elaboration of the cinema of Black theory in dub, in its relation to what Okomfor calls the formulation of a sonic backdrop, which one could only call Black industrial. It requires a return towards a conversation undertaken between the art theorist and historian Cobbler Mercer and interlocutor, long-term interlocutor and friend of Okomfor and Trevor Matheson in East London in 2015 for Black Camera Journal. In this conversation, Okomfor characterized Black audio film collective's first three works: the inaugural slide tape performance, Return to My Native Land, performed in the Student Union Bar at Portsmouth Polytechnic in 1982, of which only photographs now remain. The slide tape performance for the British Theatre of Black Women, the second work of the collective, presented at the Rio Cinema in Hackney in 1984. And the completion of Expeditions, which you saw a section of, whose first part was entitled Signs of Empire, and whose second part was entitled Images of Nationality, collectively created by Lena Gopal, Edward George, Avril Johnson, Trevor Matheson, John Okomfor, Rhys Augeast, and Claire Joseph throughout the years of 1982, 1983, and 1984, presented in art spaces such as the London Filmmakers Co-op in North London, the Four Corners Film and Video Workshop in South London, and the Institute of Contemporary Art in Central London. Referring to those years, Okomfor states, "One thing we wanted to do was to comment on the past, because there was no way forward without it. The medium of tape slide projection provided one of the easiest means for doing that, because the reproducibility of images from slides, once you had a printer, meant you could reshoot, you could reframe, you could perform something with images. Trevor, Eddie, and myself also spent time trying to pull together a sonic backdrop, which one could only call Black industrial, because post-punk was in full swing by then." End of quote. The sonic backdrop of what is called here Black industrial, Black industrialism, emerges in and through the requirement for an approach to images as performative capacities, capable of staging an encounter with the images and sounds and voices and noises and texts of the past as the precondition for an encounter with the present. As an event rather than a text, an event whose temporality, whose pulsation, whose rhythm could be developed, could be elaborated. The performative potential of images was inseparable from the cine-sonic ecology of Black industrialism, from which images emerged, to which images contributed, and in which they participated. Comfort continues. What became the post-punk and post-industrial soundtrack, weirdly enough, was a space already anticipated by the cinematic avant-garde. When you listen to Cabaret Voltaire, or Psychic TV, or Throbbing Gristle, while you were reading William Burroughs, and musicians talked about using cut-ups, a lot of those approaches already featured in soundtracks of avant-garde films and had been anticipated by the filmmakers who came to visit at Portsmouth. The sounds of the cinematic avant-garde, to which Okonkwo referred, alluded to soundtracks deployed by contemporary white structuralist British filmmakers such as Malcolm LeGrice and Guy Sherwin. The films projected in the pedagogic setting of the film studies program at Portsmouth Polytechnic at the end of the 1970s and 80s, attended by the collective, decoupled the experience of the encounter with the materiality of the cinesonic from the context of musical performance, and prefigured the collective's attention to the albums of Throbbing Gristle, such as Heathen Earth, Cabaret Voltaire, such as Voice of America, and Psychic TV, such as Force the Hand of Chance. They overdetermined the collective's subsequent encounters with film projection in the context of the Throbbing Gristle concert, the Cabaret Voltaire gig, or the Psychic TV performance. Cobbler Mercer asked Okonkwo and Matheson whether Rashida Rean's 1977 performance, Portrait of the Artist as a Black Person, which had used the medium of tape slide to combine image and text in a diaristic way, appeared in the orbit of the collection. But rather than talking about Rashida Rean, Matheson reasserted the initiatory significance of film projected as a backdrop on stage during the performance of the post-punk gig in London. Matheson stated, "I think it may have been Cabaret Voltaire, but we went to a performance where film loops with industrial imagery played behind the musician. Perhaps it was Test Department. That was more our point of reference, where we were coming from, especially regarding the audio side," close quotation marks. So in Matheson's recollection, the performance of the sonic emerges by way of the dominance of rhythms generated by film loops with industrial imagery playing behind the musicians. It is a visual encounter with rhythm that renders an impression of the semisonic, which provides the collective with what Matheson calls our point of reference. What Matheson recalls is neither the specific music performed by the group, nor even that of the group itself. What remains is the rhythm of vision, the temporal structure of those film loops. In this collaborative expectancy in time, to use the term formulated by Stephen Feld, the film loops of industrial imagery generate a cinematic rhythm that renders a visual backdrop as a cinesonic experience of temporality, a temporal experience of cinesonic rhythm that is not subordinated to musical performance, but subtends the rhythms of amplified music into the visual event of film as a rhythm that plays on the collaborative expectancies in time, which plays on the implications of amplified images whose visual impact is already sonic in its motion and in its movement. Matheson's fluctuation between Cabaret Voltaire and Test Department suggests a shared methodology of projecting film loops of industrial imagery, a methodology common to both groups, which shaped audiences' collaborative expectancies of concerts of the time. Okonkwo recalled to Cobden Mercer, quote, "I remember very strongly coming to London in 1982 to an event called the Final Academy, which was John Giorno, William Burroughs, and Test Department at the Brixton Academy. Eddie was interested in these bands too, but I was much more fascinated with the conjunction between radical literary artists and post-punk sonics, and I thought we could draw from that. Upon looking at the publication printed on the occasion of the Final Academy, entitled Statements of a Kind, what is clear is that Test Department did not participate in the Final Academy. Okonkwo could not have seen a performance by Test Department because Test Department were not present. The groups that participated in the Final Academy at Brixton Ritzy Cinema, not at Brixton Academy, as Okonkwo suggested, on the 29th of September, the 30th of September, the 1st of October, and the 2nd of October 1982 were Cabaret Voltaire, Last 3 Days, Psychic TV, 20 Feet Skidoo, and Zev. The spine of the bootleg cassette for the Cabaret Voltaire performance reads, The Final Academy, readings, music, performance, film, video exhibition. The front cover reads as follows. For the first time ever, William Burroughs reads in London. The Final Academy is a program of events celebrating William Burroughs. A rare opportunity to see William Burroughs with his lifetime collaborator Brian Gyson and John Giorno, one of the greatest New York poets, reading live in England. We have assembled a program of events that will provide the British public with a unique opportunity to experience this legendary figure, a man who has not only revolutionized literature, but is one of the mainstays of pop culture. The Final Academy brings together a diverse range of talents spanning 3 generations, throughout which William Burroughs has been a hero figure whose influence has been crucial from the Beat Generation to the present day. The Final Academy has brought together some of the most original and exciting contemporary artists. The Final Academy is not a homage, but a development towards the future. Psychic TV, Cabaret Voltaire, 23 Skidoo, Ian Hinchcliffe, Last 3 Days, Zeb, Jeff Nuttall, Paul Burwell, Anne Bean, Roger Eli, Ruth Adams, Terry Wilson, John Giorno, Brian Gyson, William Burroughs. What the conference misremembering indicates is the powerful impression made upon the collective by Test Department. Mercer responded to his recollections by reaching for 2 further comparisons that might have paralleled the collective's preoccupation with the performance poetics of Burroughs and Gyson. Mercer reaches first for the preeminence of performance poetry in the post-punk moment by citing Lynton Kwesi Johnson and John Cooper Clarke, and second by citing the existence of what he calls a performance element among gallery-based artists like David Hammons and Senga Nengudi. Mercer's examples allows Okonkwo to differentiate the collective's concerns from those of the West Coast or South London or North London or of Manchester. Okonkwo says, I certainly wasn't aware of that whole dimension. Much later, I bought an ESP album by the New York Art Quartet, and there was Leroy Jones doing Black Dada Nihilismus. And of course, one had read about the Black Arts Movement. But no, for us, the direct engagement was with Giorno, Burroughs, and what Test Department, Joy Division, Coil, or Throbbing Gristle were doing with other poets. Our points of reference were here rather than over there. There were many albums on Factory Records that that were aware of this literary and sonic conjunction. What concerns a comfort then, like Matheson, is the insistence, the emphasis that our points of reference were here in the UK rather than over there in the US. To insist that the direct engagement was with what Test Department, Joy Division, Coil or Throbbing Gristle were doing is to insist upon the industrial performance of the film loops of the industrial gig. The encounter with the rhythms of white British industrialism as the cinesonic ecology that brings together and decouples the experiences of listening to white post-punk recordings at home with that of hearing the industrial soundtrack of white structuralist cinema at college, with the subsequent experience of attending the London Filmmakers Co-op to watch screenings of what Okomfor called the formal avant-garde of white filmmakers such as Peter Goddard and Liz Rhodes. Okomfor stated, "We always felt the insights and the lessons learnt via that route were absolutely central. I would never disown the experiential value of watching avant-garde cinema and the psychic transformations that took place as you watched." In an essay entitled The Information War, written for Statements of a Kind, John Savage wrote the following. "Random events pile upon random events. And like a drowning man, the past of all ages flies before our eyes. Instead of imposing order, this vortex is received and celebrated, and then concentrated into a force of unexpected power. I have seen a couple of shows of cut-ups, towers open fire, and performances by the neophytes, Throbbing Gristle and Cabaret Voltaire, end in sudden violence as the deprogramming takes instant effect. I would consider that as a sign of success." In the same volume, Cabaret Voltaire published a brief text called Organization and Operation of the Temporary Morgue. The text states, "Conveying the information, this is the obsession. Word, sound, and image as the tools of control and as the tools of breakdown of control. Turn the thing back on itself. There is still some life left in there." When Cabaret Voltaire speak of turning the thing back on itself, how is this thing to be understood? The thing is not so much word or sound or image, not even control or information. The thing is the reversible circuit of word, sound, and image that is used as a tool of control and as a tool of breakdown control. In an interview with Edward George of Black Audio Film Collective, Mark Stewart declared himself to be into William Burroughs and cut-ups. "We all were back in the day, Throbbing Gristle, but with rhythm as well." So these preoccupations with turning the thing back on itself, these preoccupations with concentrating a vortex into a force of unexpected power, echo from a distance the Center for Cultural Studies concern with control culture and signification culture. It's concerned with the widening and tightening of spirals of demonization as racialization. The demon is a spiral. A spiral that closes itself around the signification of young black peoples through the convergence of spirals of anxiety with spirals of panic. When the Final Academy, when the texts collected in Final Academy what the Final Academy texts articulate in a vocabulary of control, information warfare, ritual, magic, focus, discipline, conspiracy, and paranoia, the Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies enunciate in a language of control agents, signification, articulation, conjuncture, crisis, and closure. What they share is a preoccupation with the demonology of media and demonology by media. In 1985, in the text, The Secret Public, Savage argued that it is clear that the central modern rituals are those contained within the new condition of the mass media. If ritual is best seen as an organized way to harness power or to make things happen, performed along rigid lines, but evading conventional rational analysis, then its most powerful expression now rests in a place and a form that is barely recognized. Today's rituals are not carried out personally or from within a small community, but through a mass central repetition and reception. They are not performed by shamans or purifying spirits, but by venal agents, the right-wing cartels that run the newspapers and are now setting their sights on broadcasting. The effects of these rituals is not to bring about a specific personal or group awareness, but to bring a seeping loss of power to the mass. Against the dominant ritual that diverts intervention into explicit shapes of private enterprise, law and order, celebrity and fear, the Handsworth rioters, headline-hungry murderers, even the Jesus and Mary chain gang, are all assimilated into media folklore, ready for the camera. Such challenges become less of a threat and more of a reflection of the dominant new right culture. If industrial culture targeted media as a system of mass ritual, and if such mass rituals demonized blacks, gays, minors, witches, then Black Audio Film Collective's preoccupation with industrial culture's counter-rituals, with industrial culture's tools of blacklessness, with a music whose unmarked denomination rendered it open in principle, rendered it a means for countering mass media rituals of criminalization through circular causation, tautologies of racialization, self-confirming loops of demonization. Their engagement with industrial culture was a recognition of the necessity to confront the rituals whose effects produced the doppelganger, the double body of the lawless rioter, the double body of the violent mugger, the double body that operated as a figure of racecraft that defied conventional rational analysis. Black Audio Film Collective drew out the blackness of industrial culture's blacknessness. That is to say, they blackened the geography of industrialism. In his essay, Secret Public, Savage compared the riots in Handsworth at 9:30 p.m. on 9 September 1985 with the riot at a Jesus and Mary chain gig at a Camden Town venue on 10:45 p.m. on the same night of Monday, 9 September 1985. In the former, newspapers acted as public agents of mass deflation that operated through mass rituals of comparative deflation, that is, in response to the Jesus and Mary chain. And in response to the riots, newspapers acted as agents of containment that operated through mass rituals of denunciation. John Savage noted that the newspaper's coverage of Handsworth rapidly, quote, streamlined into one picture that is emblazoned across every tabloid within 36 hours. a West Indian youth walking with a Molotov cocktail in his hand, is singled out as the hyperbolic image of the riot. A man who walks with a chilling swagger, a petrol bomb in his hand, and hate in his heart. And Savage is quoting from the Daily Express on the 11th of September. What if the blacklessness of white post-punk, the blacklessness of white structuralist cinema, the blacklessness of white industrial music, the blacklessness of white film screenings at the filmmaker's co-op, engendered what Catherine McKittrick, in her theorization of black Canadian geographies, in Demonic Grounds, Black Women and the Cartographies of Struggle, characterizes as, quote, surprise that presumes both blacklessness prior to the surprise and wonder, the emotion evoked by surprise, or in this case, blackness. The element of surprise that attaches itself to the Black Audio Film Collective, attending the four nights of the Final Academy in Brixton, or attending screenings at the London Filmmakers Co-op. The surprise at the existence of the Black Audio Film Collective in the US and in Europe. The wonder at the presence of the Black Audio Film Collective in North London or Central London can be analogized to the element of surprise that greets Black Canadians, which, argues Catherine McKittrick, quote, holds Black Canada in tension with the nation's ceaseless outlawing of blackness. Blackness is surprising because it should not be here, was not here before, was always here, is only momentarily here, was always over there, beyond Canada, for example. This means then that black people in Canada are also presumed surprises because they are not here and here simultaneously. They are, like blackness, unexpected, shocking, concealed in a landscape of systemic blacklessness, and they exist in a landscape of blacklessness and have astonishingly rich lives which contradict the essential black subject. What the black surprise, the blackless black, or the Black Audio Film Collective announces is, quote, a regard to how blacklessness is black and blackens geography in ways that are, depending on perspective, unintelligible. The black surprise, the blacklessly black, ideally welcomes a long-standing diasporic presence that cannot be understood on the geographic terms that make them possible. To regard Black Audio Film Collective's blackening of the geography of industrialism that makes them possible, but which cannot comprehend them, is to draw attention to the absented presence of the blackless blackness of black industrialism of the Black Audio Film Collective. The key interventions of the 20th century, argues John Savage in 1985, require a counter-ritual that will concern itself with what he calls the demonology of media. Cutting up newspaper photographs and articles in Handsworth Songs appears to be a counter-ritual that attacks the demonological powers of British national and regional newspapers on their own terms. By cutting up, animating, the news photos, the captions, the stand firsts, the headlines, the articles, with the rostrum camera, camera, the collective disassembles the media into 18 images and texts that do the work of demonization. The collective's turn to industrial music can be understood as a recourse to a counter-ritual that attacks the demonology of media on its own terms. The counter-demonological powers of industrial music practice a ritual capable of counter-demonizing the demonology of media. Such a task entails extending Okonkwo's formulation of the Black industrial sonic backdrop beyond the slide tape performance of Notebook of a Return to My Native Land, beyond that of Theatre of Black Women, beyond expeditions, towards the process of research undertaken in 1985 by the collective into the constitution of the Industrial Reserve Army of Blackness, the Industrial Reserve Army of Labour, a research that was interrupted by the riots in September and October 1985 in Handsworth and Tottenham and Brixton, interrupted by the acts of unlawful and riotous assembly that brought them to the West Midlands. Looking back at those 3 years of work between 82 and 84, Comfort stated that everything we found both desirable and repugnant went into it, by which he means expeditions, signs of empire, images of nationality. It felt that once you returned to that primal scene of the colonial, be it as fantasy, as desiring machine, or as forms of terror, you are opening a gateway to a new set of possibilities. If expeditions provided the gateway that opened a new set of possibilities for 1985 and beyond, if it provided the condition of possibility for what would become Handsworth Songs, then it could be said that the collective's return to the primal scene of the colonial, its ambition to stage the primacy of the colonial scene, is what required or necessitated the collective to fashion a Black industrial aesthetic. The project of inventing a Black industrial aesthetic was not so much a question of providing a soundtrack to the tape slide works, as it was a question of constructing a cine-sonic ecology that could sustain its own existence by, quote, drawing everything we found both desirable and repugnant, end quote, into its own terrain. Everything desirable that could be transmitted. Everything repugnant that might be broadcast. Everything desirably repugnant and repugnantly desirable. Everything capable of being mixed. Understood in this expanded ecological scale, a cine-sonic ecology of Black industrialism could not do other than persist beyond the event of the tape slides. Could not but insist in and as and of Handsworth Songs. In 1988, Coco Fusco perceptively characterized the ecology of the cine-sonic in the terms of what she called the experiences of a cultural environment that afforded the collective the capacity to, quote, draw on the experiences of a cultural environment in which musical performance can function as a laboratory for experimenting with ready-made technologically reproduced materials. Fusco stopped short of nominating the precise cultural environment or the precise musical performance that can and did function as a laboratory for experimenting. Instead of naming a precise environment, Fusco's footnote referred readers to Diaspora, Utopia, and the Critique of Capitalism, Chapter 5 of Paul Gilroy's There Ain't No Black in Union Jack, the Cultural Politics of Race and Nation, In Guillou's account of the sound system as the public performance of recorded music, in Chapter 5, Guillou wrote, "Perhaps the most important effect of the sound systems on the contemporary musical culture of Black Britain is revealed in the way that it is centered not in live performances by music and singers, although these are certainly appreciated, but on records. Public performance of recorded music is primary in both reggae and soul variations of the culture. In both, records become raw materials for spontaneous performances of cultural creation, in which the DJ and the MC, or the toaster, who introduces each disc or sequence of discs, emerge as the principal agents in dialogic ritual of active and celebratory consumption. It is above all in these performances that Black Britain has expressed the improvisation, spontaneity, and intimacy, which are the key characteristics of all New World Black musicians, providing a living bridge between them and African traditions of music making, which dissolve the distinctions between art and life, artifact and expression, which typify the contrasting traditions of Europe. Sound system culture redefines the meaning of the term performance by separating the input of the artist who originally made the work from the equally important work of those who adapt and rework it, so that it directly expresses the moment in which it has been consumed, however remote this may be from the original context of production. The key to this process is the orality of the artistic forms involved." Guillou's emphasis on performance as dialogical ritual stresses the living bridge between Black Britain and African traditions of music making, which dissolve the distinctions between art and life. Without ever naming it, however, Fusco's notion of a laboratory could also be said to characterize the Black industrial music performed by the collective from the years of 1982 to 1984, and I'm arguing beyond. In fact, throughout their career. What if Coco Fusco's laboratory for experimenting with ready-made, technologically reproduced materials operated not only for Guillou's sound system, but also for the redefinition of performance enacted by the collective's Black industrial music? What if the collective's cinesonic ecology of Black industrial music emerged in and by way of their concern with the collective reconfiguration of sound system culture towards an industrial ecology of dread? How would the collective's ecology reconfigure Guillou's emphasis on oral culture? How would it place pressure on the characteristics that Guillou asserted was shared by all New World musics? In what ways did the industrial ecology of desire and dread stress test what Guillou called the living bridge between Black British and African traditions of music making? Matson described the sound that he composed for Notebook of a Return to My Native Land as, quote, "low frequencies that created an ebb and flow of rhythmic tonal rumbling. The main thing is we built the bass bins as the seating arrangement. It was in a student union bar rather than a lecture theatre, but we had four big sub-bass speakers at the back, then speakers on the side as well, with members of the group on stage, standing between sheets of muslin and light and the lighting rig. The sound was heavily processed with echo and reverb, so that at different parts of the poem you could extend the voice or the phrase. Then someone else would come in. So there was a continual layering of voice on top of this juggernaut of sound that was driving the sonics. What Okomfor stressed was that the fragmented text of Césaire's Return to My Native Land coalesced around the voice of what he called this first-person figure returning to the space which is both a space of desire and dread. What Return to My Native Land offered us in its first-person narrative was access to certain emotional states, which is what we were interested in, rather than the tale it told. Ours was a heavily abstracted version of it, in which we literally took a Barrosian approach to the text. The collective's preoccupation with desire and dread performed through readings that took a Barrosian approach to the text of Césaire, processed with echo and reverb, which dropped out and cut through and floated on low frequencies, that created an ebb and flow of rhythmic tonal rumbling, rooted through four big bass speakers, big sub-bass speakers at the back, and speakers on the side as well, suggests that the Black Audio Film Collective set out to reconfigure the sonic ecology of the sound system beyond the dialogic rituals of active and celebratory consumption described by Gilroy. What if the collective redirected Gilroy's emphasis on improvisation, spontaneity, and intimacy away from transmitting reggae and soul towards mixing the times and spaces of desire and dread in order to sustain and to inhabit the environment of, quote, everything we found both desirable, pugnant. What Black Audio Film Collective had built was a sound system that redirected the collaborative expectancies of time, shared by audiences shaped by the anticipations of reggae and the satisfactions of soul, towards the manufacture of a psychological sonorum sustained by the encounter with everything we found both desirable and repugnant. What the collective had engineered was a psychic transformation on the radiophonic terrain, configured between the poles of the graveyard and the ballroom, animated by the imperatives of death disco. To think the relation of Black industrialism to cinema in dark requires analysis to differentiate Handsworth Song's adoption and adaptation of dub from the roots or the steppers or the militant reggae requisitioned by Black British cinema, dedicated to the affirmation of the struggle for Black community. To quote the title of the documentary cycle directed by Colin Prescott, the activist and historian at Rickson Class. What requires analysis are the implications of the collective's distance from reggae's evocation of cinema. What requires analysis, what is required is an analysis that draws out the repercussions of the collective's challenge to the realism that shapes the testimonial cinema of Black British documentary in its relation to Black British cinematic fictions. What repercussions emerge from the collective's redirection of reggae towards the project of anti-realism. What remains to be measured is the meaning entailed by the distance Handsworth Songs evokes between its audition of dub and Menelik Shabazz's Step Forward Youth in 1977, which we saw at the beginning, which opens and closes with a rendition of Prince Jazbo's exquisite Step Forward Youth with his beautiful refrain, "Run Capitalist, I and I Want Socialist," from 1974. What remains to be understood is the expanse that Handsworth Songs opens between itself and David Koff's documentary, Blacks Britannica, in 1978, which opens and concludes with Steel Pulse's Handsworth Revolution from 1978, a song whose absence from Handsworth Songs speaks volume for the collective's distance towards and from Steel Pulse's invocation of the prospects of or for Black Revolution in Britain. What remains to be analysed is the gap between the collective's evocation of dread and Franco Rosso's study of Poet and the Roots, that's Lyndon Kwesi Johnson's initial name, Poet and the Roots' articulation of dread in the musicalizations of the poem contained in the volume Dread Beaten Blood in 1975, for the album Dread Beaten Blood in 1978, filmed by Franco Rosso Poe's documentary Dread Beaten Blood in 1979. What remains to be analyzed is the space between the idea of dub deployed by the collective in its portrait of Jah Shaka and the sound clashes of Shaka, dramatized by Franco Rossi in 1980 in his film Babylon. What remains to be analyzed is the separation between Menelik Shabazz's Blood Aga Run in 1982, which begins with a young activist declaring that Blood Aga Run, and concludes with the poignancy of Johnny Osborne's 13 Dead and Nothing Said, 1981. What remains to be understood and to be analysed as such is the interval between the collective's understanding of dub as a black morphology, to use Keith Hudson's term, in the opening minutes of Handsworth Songs, as it measures itself against Cheddo's The People's Account from 1986, which opens and closes with the resilience of Black Uhuru's Youths of Eglinton from 1980. In each of these films, in their selection of compositions by Black Uhuru, by Johnny Osborne, by Jah Shaka, by Poet and the Roots, by Steel Pulse, by Prince Jazbo, in each of these films, in each of these compositions, these films elevate the A-side of this reggae vinyl record to the anthem of cinema. Each of these films institutes a sound system in and through its montage. Each of these films could be understood in their variation as a cinema of the A-side, a cinema that marshals the force of reggae, of the reggae sound system, to chant down Babylon. A cinema that seeks to defend, to sustain, to vindicate, and to repair Black communities under distress, under heavy manners, downpressed by racial rule, suffering from the structured secondariness of informal and formal segregation in the decaying urban rings of Britain's major urban conurbation. In these films, Black Britain plays itself. This cinema of the A-side defends the Black community menaced by what Stuart Hall calls the synchronization of the race and class aspects of the crisis, in which the policing of the blacks threatens to mesh with the problem of policing the poor and policing the unemployed. It is a cinema in which the concentration of crisis in the same urban areas provides the elements of geographical homogeneity which facilitate the process that Stuart Hall et al. Call the germination of militant consciousness. A consciousness whose germination is amplified by each of these films. Sankofa's documentary, Territories, by contrast, can be understood as a cinema of the B-side. Maybe Sankofa's essay film is more appropriate. A cinematic vision in which the version of dub and as B-side, as version, provides the subject and the form for a form of cinema in which, as Paul Gilroy argues in his essay From Bad to Worse, for Isaac Julian's catalogue, Riot, the growing power of organized sound and music counterpoints the visual montage and is articulated with it aesthetically. Gilroy declares Territories to be a dub aesthetic, performed by narrators that sit at a Steinbeck editing machine, underscoring their responsibilities as mediators. But the DJs and the MCs who make up People's War are not positioned at a distance. Under the time-stretching impact of what we must call a dub aesthetic, one grasping the shock that only the unintelligible can communicate, the film demands to be encountered as a remix. Its repeated phrases, oscillations, and orchestrations depart from reggae. Their relocation to the grey northern metropolis has opened them to the emergent power of hip-hop and what we used to call electro. What Territories makes visible? What it dramatizes is dub as the technological method, the sonic process that masters reality. Through its figuration of narrators at the controls of the editing machine, it transposes the figure of the engineer with his fingers on the sliders of the mixing desk to that of the female editor whose fingertips mix the parameters of mediation, who manipulates time and space by shaping the times of sound, by contouring its spaces. If Territories is a cinema of the B-side, a cinema that performs dub at the controls, then Hands With Songs moves by a politics of echo, oscillating as it elides, as it does the police in different voices. Listen, all parts of the community, 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 all parts of the community. In the local news, 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 in the local news. On the streets this morning, on the streets this morning, late last, this day remains, 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 this day remains. Hands With Songs is neither a cinema of the A-side nor a cinema of the B-side. In the silhouetted portrait of Jar Shaka's sounding, of Vivian Jones's track Flashit and Guam, in the subtracted rendition of Mark Stewart and the Mafia's version of Jerusalem, in its 18 scenes of media counter-ritual, which bring John Savage's contention that the key interventions of the 20th century, the age of the media spell, have all been concerned with the demonology of media, into contact, into resonance with Stuart Hall et al.'s argument that, quote, each surge of social anxiety finds a temporary respite in the projection of fears onto and into certain compellingly anxiety-laden themes. The discovery of demons, the identification of folk devils, the mounting of moral campaigns, the expiation of prosecution and control in the moral panic. In the proletarian regional white working men's choral version of Jerusalem that echoes across the terrain to Adrian Sherwood's version, can be heard an antiphonal unisonance that institutes a relation within and across the temporal terrain of Handsworth's songs, Handsworth's radiophonic songs, drawing the song that is heard in what Brophy calls the noise of the crowd, the song that is authorless per citation, but authorful per density of reference and spread of relevance, into a relation with noise engendered by what Kamau Brathwaite calls congregational kinesis, assembling samples from authorless rituals of televised unisonance into a cinesonic ecology of noise. Such a relation between antiphony and unisonance deserves its own sustained reading. In the first 8 to 10 minutes of Black Audio Film Collective, which is effectively what we've been analysing for these past two lectures, what emerges is not so much the mutation of dub by industrial music, or the reconfiguration of industrial music by dub, or the reimagination of musique concrète by dub, or the concretization of dub by musique concrète. Rather, it is as if industrial music, as if musique concrète, as if dub is being stress tested for its capacity to speak of states of becoming at the limit of semantic availability. It is not so much, or not only, that industrial music becomes the ecology for dub that defamiliarizes itself, and that dub becomes the ecology for the estrangement of industrial music, which draws the clang of musique concrète into the orbit of political becoming. It is more the case that what emerges is a cinesonic ecology that seeks a disquiet. What if the quality of dread articulated by Rastafarianism, impossible to understand outside of its history, is pursued without recourse to the signatures of reggae, without the alibis evoked by reggae? What if the electronic undertow of Handsworth song seeks to sustain a sense of foreboding, of debility, disenchantment, demoralization, disconsolation, powerlessness, defeat, whose articulation is blocked by the vocabulary of the campaigning activist video, whose articulation is inhibited by the imperatives of leftist documentary, whose articulation is contained by the very idea of community? What emerges in Handsworth's songs in its first 8 to 10 minutes is a music without alibis, a music without the guarantees of what community is supposed to hold in common, a music without the assurance of blackness, the music without the assurance provided by the invocation of reggae, the evocation of dub, or the affirmation of the sound system that holds the time of the community in the living bridge to Africa. The songs in Handsworth Songs do not provide the grounds for securing the contours of community in the terms formulated by Hebditch, Dick Hebditch that is, or by Paul Gilroy, or even by Stuart Hall. Even as Handsworth Songs announces a sound system in its ecological understanding of sound, even as it opens a system in black sound, a sound for a black system in cinema, a cinesonic system for a black cinema. At certain times, some songs do provide a ground, a geography, for securing the contours of community, partially. At other times, some songs, some music, do not. That is to say, neither musics, nor songs, nor sounds can be relied upon to raise the images until they stand tall or proud. Handsworth Songs' musics, its songs cannot be relied upon for support or for security. Instead, its blackness, blackness. It's intermittent, interrupted, blackless, blackness. Proceeds without guarantees of sustenance or community. Its music lets its images fall. Its music lets its images down. Its music fails its images. Its music collapses, subsides, succumbs to disconsolation, disenchantment, disappointment, neither heroic nor anti-heroic, but unadmitted, unbelongings. It is this stance towards the sonic that provides Handsworth Songs with its cinesonic agnosticism. It is not a matter of adjudicating between black industrialism and dub cinema, between black or white musics. The music that insists on its Britishness as a long-standing diasporic presence, which cannot be understood on the geographic terms of Britishness that makes them possible. Even as it formulates a music that inhabits a state of ontological certainty, a state of ontological vertigo, musics that insist on their mutant status, sounds which acknowledge that they do not know who they are or what they are, musics which state that I think they don't know who they are or what they are. I think they don't know who they are or what they are. I think they don't know who they are or what they are. And really what you're asking me is how one gives them the kind of sense of belonging that young Englishmen have. Really what you're asking me is how one gives them the kind of sense of belonging that white Englishmen have. As is so often the case in the UK, right-wingers make perceptive statements for all the wrong reasons. And this quotation is one of them. In its distance towards blackness, in its advance into blacklessness, in its embrace of its blackness, blackness, in its scattering of blackness, in its dissemination of blackness into a blackness, blackness. it becomes possible to begin to account for the dispute between Paul Gilroy, Jim Pines, Rhys Augeast, Linda Gopal, John Okumfra, in the pages of Framework Journal in 1988, a dispute that circles around questions of audience, around questions of Black spectatorship, a debate that turns on the capacity of Handsworth songs, not only to dramatize the proprietary right to enunciation or to enunciate the limits of community, but to confront spectators with the music whose semisonic implications, in the words of David Marriott's text, The X of Representation, rereading Stuart Hall, denotes, quote, a struggle not over representation, but with the racial limits of the representable as such, close quotation marks. In Handsworth Songs, the music in which the frontier effects between Black and white no longer seem audible or tenable or sustainable, a music in which the recourse to civil disorder no longer provides the alibis for the sustenance of the frontier effect, and a music whose collapse into this abyss, into this fall, into this sound which falls, is part of the semisonic ecology of Black Britons at the scene of their own making, at the scene of their coming into existence, of their, that is our, political belonging, and our, that is their, psychic unbelonging. A music whose ends, whose questions with regards to its ends, its objects, its motives, its intentions, confronts itself with the recursive question that David Marriott calls, quote, the limits and modalities of Blackness itself. The opening scenes of Handsworth Songs engenders an uncertainty that announces David Marriott's question in advance of David Marriott's formulation, quote, what would it mean to bring Blackness to an end, to tell its story differently, by bringing to an end the innocent forms of its formulation, and this ending being read, and here we would have to say being heard, in turn, as an obscure, undecidable beginning. Okay. Thank you.